Well, good morning, stalwarts. Thank you for coming out, you wonderful people. We will begin, as usual, with some announcements. Please mark your calendar for a weekend retreat at the very end of April. Swami Nirakaranandaji of the Vedanta Society of St. Louis will be here from Friday evening, April 26th, until Sunday morning on the 28th, offering us his wisdom about Raja Yoga. Swami Nirakaranandaji is an assistant minister, has been for some years. He's Argentine by birth and is a remarkable singer and musician. So most of his instruction on Saturday will be in the form of songs and explaining the meaning and the significance of those songs to us. So very much looking forward to Swami Nirakaranandaji coming. Seva Saturday for April will fall on the 14th of the month. Please note that date. It's the second Saturday of the month, as usual. Please join us sometime between 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. This is a fine way to show your dedication to the center and its success. And, you know, we'll get the center looking. There's spring has sprung, as they say, and with it a lot of weeds. And we're hoping that the weather will be auspicious that day for some outdoor work. And just a bulletin about next Sunday's talk. It's about the three phases of spiritual attainment that can result from the practice of contemplation, concentration, and meditation. We will define and discuss self-discovery, self-actualization, and self-realization. I think that's all of the announcements, unless there's something I've missed. All right, we'll open with our chant, which is a recollection of our purpose here and our sweet relationship with the divine being. Om Sahana Vavatu, Sahano Bhunaktu, Sahaviryam Karavavahai, Tejasvinavaditamastu, Ma Vidvishavahai. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. May the Divine Being look over us lovingly as a mother and father. May the Divine Being support and nourish us as a mother and father. May we have the strength and skill to study together the art of spirituality. May no misunderstandings arise amongst us. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Peace, peace, peace be unto us and to all beings everywhere. So this morning, rather than a song, I'm going to read you a poem. And as you hear the talk, you'll see the relationship of the talk to this poem by St. Francis of Assisi. It's called Our Need for Thee. In our ever-present need for Thee, beloved, let us know Your peace. Let us be Your instruments that break every shackle, for do not the caged ones weep. And give us our inheritance of divine love so that we can forgive like You. Let us be wise so that we do not wed another's madness and make them in debt to us for the deep gash their helpless, raging lance will cause. Darkness is an unlit wick. Darkness is an unlit wick. It just needs your touch, beloved, to become a sacred flame. And what sadness in this world could endure if it looked into your eyes? God is like a honeybee. He doesn't mind me calling him that. For when you are kind, sweet, he nears and can draw you into himself. What is there to understand of each other? If a wand turned the sun into the moon, would not the moon mourn the ecstatic effulgence it once was? We are all in mourning for the experience of our essence we knew and now miss. Light is the cure, all else a placebo. Yes, I will console any creature before me that is not laughing or full of passion for their art or life, for laughing and passion, beautiful, beauty and joy is our heart's truth. All else is labor and foreign to the soul. I have stood in his rain and now fill granaries as do the fertile plains. Giving is as natural to love as sound from the mouth. There is a courageous dying. It is called effacement. That holy death unfurls your spirit's wings and allows you to embrace God even as you stand on the earth. There is a courageous dying. It is called effacement. That holy death unfurls your spirit's wings and allows you to embrace God even as you stand on the earth. That's from Love Poems from God, 12 Sacred Voices from the East and West, selected and translated and annotated by Daniel Ladinsky. This is our last talk in March. March is a month for the study of Karma Yoga, a spiritual path leading to the abandonment of selfishness. As a Karma Yogi, you practice offering your actions and their results, as well as your perceptions, thoughts, and feelings to the Divine Presence. Even before knowing this presence, you hold firmly to the belief that the presence is within each person or other living being that you interact with or serve. Working and abiding in this spirit, you are increasingly able to release attachment to your activities and their results. This yields the freedom and contentment promised by Karma Yoga. As Sri Krishna says to Arjuna in chapter 2 of the Gita, even a little practice of this yoga will save you from the terrible wheel of rebirth and death. So we're going to look at the Baal Shem Tov's principles. The title of this morning's talk is The Principles of the Baal Shem Tov. We're going to look at what he said within the context of what we think of as Karma Yoga. And the reason I read you the St. Francis of Assisi poem is that there are many similarities between this 18th century saint, he died in 1760, this 18th century saint, many similarities between him and St. Francis of Assisi. For example, the Baal Shem Tov, his given name was Israel, but we'll call him the Baal Shem Tov. The Baal Shem Tov means master of the good word. And of course, what it's referring to is that the words of a holy man must come true. So whatever a holy man says becomes a good word, and his mastery of the what we would think of as the gunas will result in that whatever he has said coming true. so Baal Shem Tov. This is a quote from the Baal Shem Tov. I'll read it, and then you'll find it again in the context of the speech of the talk later. Quote, "Neither thinking about the day of one's death, nor the fear of punishment in hell, will arouse a person's heart to serve God. But yearning to cling to the source of life and goodness will do so. And neither fasting nor afflicting oneself will be of any help. But forgetting oneself out of the depth of one's yearning will do so." The Baal Shem Tov. What is he talking about? Arouse a person's heart to serve God. And this is the heart of Karma Yoga, as expressed by Sri Krishna in chapters 2 and 3 of the Gita. Offer everything to me. Serve me. Yearning to cling to the source of life and goodness will arouse that person's heart. Forgetting oneself out of the depths of one's yearning will do so. This Jewish saint's mystical wisdom is very familiar to us. Sri Ramakrishna also taught that yearning can draw you into an intimate relationship with the personal God or goddess, which the Baal Shem Tov referred to as the source of life and goodness, which of course we recognize that is the truth. Rabbi Israel Baal Shem Tov, who was born in 1698 and died in 1760, as I said, his name means master of the good word or the good name, was founder of the 18th century Hasidic movement in Eastern Europe. He helped revolutionize Jewish thought and gave new hope to an embattled people. During the late 17th century, European Jewry was still recovering from the pogroms of 1648 and 1649. Those massacres killed tens of thousands of Jews, primarily in Eastern Europe and Russia. Those massacres killed tens of thousands of Jews. Survivors struggled to rebuild their broken lives and communities. The transformative power of the Baal Shem Tov teachings are still felt today by his followers, the Hasidim, and by other rabbis and observant Jews who experience the uplifting effects of the saint's legacy. This morning we will hear and discuss more of the Baal Shem Tov's principles relating his wisdom to what we study as Karma Yoga. But first, I'm going to tell you a little bit about the Baal Shem Tov and why he's thought of in the same way as we think of St. Francis of Assisi. He was orphaned when he was 5 years old. Both his mother and father died. He became a child of the village, which was in what we think of now as Poland. He began to stray away from the village and into the forests. He worried his caretakers a good deal. But he felt a great kinship. Now, this was a child, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 years old. He began to wander into the forest and find great solace there. He spoke, that is to say, he conversed with the plants and the trees and with the animals in the same way that we hear that St. Francis of Assisi did. And his heart overflowed, even as a child, with love for anything that was imprisoned, anything that was trapped, anything that was restrained. When he was 12, he encountered one of the wandering saints of the Jewish movement. These people were at risk if they stayed in one place, these holy people. So one day Israel heard this man, whose name he never learned. Chanting verses from the Torah in the forest. And he came close to him and the man said, come with me. And so for the next 3 years, Israel traveled with this saint. There was a hidden fellowship, a hidden group of Talmudic and Torah scholars. Tzadidim, I don't pronounce it well. It's a Ashkenazi word. And so this man taught him a great deal. And so by the time, and notice this similarity, there's bound to be some subtle reason for this, which I don't know, but there's bound to be. Notice the similarity between him and Sri Chaitanya, not Chaitanya, Adi Shankaracharya. At age 16, he began his spiritual work. He had learned on his own, and then he had learned from this wandering saint. And his reputation grew and grew and grew and grew until he became this transformative power. And so now we'll study some of his teachings. I could go on for literally hours about the stories of his life, but that's enough to give you some sense of what it was that he was rooted in, this study of the Talmud, the Torah, and Kabbalah, the mystical side of the Jewish tradition. This is translated by someone from the Baal Shem Tov Foundation. His name is Yaakov David Shulman, and he writes, following are some of the principles that the Baal Shem Tov taught his holy students. This precious text was found in the possession of a grandson of the Baal Shem Tov in Hamburg. Now, again, think St. Francis of Assisi and think Sri Ramakrishna when you hear these words, because this is very familiar to us. You may recall that Sri Ramakrishna says, of course, the Lord hears your prayer. He hears the footfall of an ant. So hear this from the Baal Shem Tov in that sense. Everything that happens in the world, no matter how insignificant, comes from God. And so do not concern yourself with whether or not what has occurred is in accordance with your will. Everything that happens in the world, no matter how insignificant, comes from God. And so do not concern yourself with whether or not what has occurred in this is in accordance with your will. And of course, we have Sri Krishna in chapter 3 of the Gita saying, don't be deceived by Maya, don't be deceived by everything happens by my will. Everything, without exception. Second quote, "The entire Torah and the entire world contain nothing but the light of the Infinite One. Blessed be He, concealed within them." All the verses that speak of this, such as "there is no other than He," and "I fill the heavens and the earth," are to be taken literally. And what do we hear in the Upanishads? Brahman pervades everything. What do we hear in the words, the big O words? The divine is omnipresent, omniscient, omnipotent. All the verses that speak of this, such as "there is no other than He," and "I fill the heavens and the earth," are to be taken literally. There is no act, word, or thought in which the essence of divinity is not constricted and hiding. Sri Ramakrishna said similar things. There is no act, word, or thought in which the essence of divinity is not constricted and hiding. Now, this came to us very clearly in Swami Vivekananda's discussion of moha, limitation. The divine in time, space, and causation is simply limited. Limited. As it appears to us. Not truly limited, but it appears to be limited because of our inability with finite minds to know the infinite. So Swami Vivekananda spoke of Maya, Shakti, personal God, as nothing but Brahman with name and form. So this is exactly what the Baal Shem Tov is pointing to. And Sri Krishna says in chapter 3, people pass by me, not seeing me, though I am there in plain sight. And the Baal Shem Tov goes on. "And so when you look and see with your mind's eye, you will see the inner life force aspect of everything, not just its outer superficial layer. You will see nothing but the divine power inside all things that is giving them life, being, and existence at every moment. And when you listen carefully to the inner voice within any physical sound that you hear, you will hear only the voice of God as, at that moment, it is literally giving life and existence to the sound you are hearing. This is Shabda Brahman. Brahman is all sound. All sound is an aspect of Om. Om is Brahman. So this is what the Baal Shem Tov is telling us. And this is where you can see Krishna say, because I am everything and I am doing everything, offer everything to me. So we hear from the Baal Shem Tov this next quote. "The exile of God's presence refers to the life force and divine power that gives a person life and existence even at the moment that he is transgressing God's will." When we're missing the mark, the power that gives us the ability to do that, the life force. "Speech cannot hold thee, nor mind," Vivekananda wrote. "Speech cannot hold thee, nor mind, yet without thee we think not, nor speak, or act." What is there to understand of each other? If a wand turned the sun into the moon, would not the moon mourn the ecstatic effulgence it once was? Now, this is St. Francis of Assisi again. What is there to understand of each other? If a wand turned the sun into the moon, would not the moon mourn the ecstatic effulgence it once was? We are all in mourning for the experience of our essence we knew and now miss. Light is the cure. All else is a placebo. And this, we're all in mourning for the experience of our essence we knew and now miss, is the exile of God's presence that the Baal Shem Tov speaks of. Now, I told you I'd return to this, and we'll talk more about it. Neither thinking about the day of one's death, nor the fear of punishment in hell, will arouse a person's heart to serve God. But yearning to cling to the source of life and goodness will do so. And neither fasting nor afflicting oneself will be of any help. But forgetting oneself out of the depths of one's yearning will do so. The comparison with St. Francis of Assisi. There is a courageous dying. It is called effacement. That holy death unfurls your spirit's wings and allows you to embrace God even as you stand on the earth. Forgetting oneself out of the depths of one's yearning, that is that courageous dying that St. Francis is speaking of. We place so much value on this stardust spacesuit that is our garment and all of the things that are associated with it. So much value we place on it. He that would save his life shall lose it. That's what Christ said. Next quote from the Baal Shem Tov. Every person in his own right is essentially a complete spiritual Torah. Every person in his own right is essentially a complete spiritual Torah. Now, if you understand Torah from particularly the mystical Jewish point of view, it is the divine itself. So this is, in my mind, this is perfectly equivalent to the Mahavakya Tattvamasi, that thou art. You are the complete spiritual Torah, the divine presence. If he goes in God's path, that Torah is absorbed into his being according to his level. And we understand this in this context. A knower of Brahman becomes Brahman. Next quote. God's providence extends to all created beings, even to inanimate objects and plants. There is nothing that is not viewed from above in every detail. Everything was made with a particular intent, and a word to the wise is sufficient. How beautifully said. What does Sri Krishna say? This that you are experiencing was created by the Atman for its own purposes. Does this sound like nothing that is not viewed from There is nothing that is not viewed from above in every detail. Everything was made with a particular intent. You were made with a particular intent. And only through the practice of contemplation, concentration, and meditation will that intent be discerned. But we begin to move toward the ability of deep contemplation, concentration, meditation by self-surrender, by abandoning selfishness. Because it's only in that calmness of a mind that is no longer so self-concerned that these truths can arise. When your mind is calm, when you have done that self-effacement, even a little practice of this, says Sri Krishna. And Vivekananda translated that as, if you can be unselfish even for 5 minutes, you will learn so much that you will be able to go forward. If you can be truly unselfish for even 5 minutes. So this is the end of the quotes in that particular document that was from the Baal Shem Tov Foundation. There are more. Let's see how we're doing for time. Good. But I'd like to pause here and do what we normally do at the end, and that is open this up to discussion. Here we have all of these wonderful insights, these great teachings of this demonstrably powerful saint. I mean, he arose in the 18th century, and it's now the 21st century, 300 years later, and the Hasidim still persist. And Sri Ramakrishna said, whenever you see this kind of demonstration of power, you know it is the divine presence that we're seeing. So he, in a sense, saved his people. He was a savior of his people at the time when they were so demoralized and so lost and so shattered as a society, as a community. His teachings and his presence and his healing brought them together and so founded the Hasidic movement. What is this? What are these sayings of his? How do you respond? How do you feel about what the Baal Shem Tov says?
I think little bit that I read about Baal Shem.
Mm-hmm.
One thing stood out that I could be wrong, but I remember he said that you don't have to leave the world to pursue spirituality.
Exactly.
Like Krishna says,
mm-hmm.
that stay in the world and still you can surrender what you do to God,
mm-hmm.
karma way, or through jnana, through bhakti.
Mm-hmm.
So I see some parallel between Hasidic, is it?
Hasidic, yeah.
And I would like to know a little bit more about Hasidic movement. What are the principles, same as Baal Shem or different?
What are these? We've been studying the principles of the Hasidic movement. Like all movements, it has somewhat degenerated from what he taught. in the beginning, this Hasidim were inclusive. Now they are more exclusive. And one of the reasons is they were attacked by the traditional Torah scholars because of their inclusiveness, because of their humility. The Baal Shem Tov taught that simplicity was the way to have a sweet personal relationship with the God, with God, with the Godhead, to pray very simply, not these elaborate prayers of the Torah scholars. There's a great story, I won't go into it, but if you study the life of Baal Shem Tov, he encountered one of these great Torah scholars one time, and he said, "What are you doing?" And the man said, "Who are you, you insignificant person? Go away." Well, the Baal Shem Tov won that argument. Very like Adi Shankaracharya would debate the great scholars of his time in various fields. Anyone else? That was wonderful, Uma. Thank you. Yes.
So I have a comment about for Uma about Hasidics and how they practice today. Just a little bit of knowledge, not as deep as yours, but so in Judaism, most of the Judaism you see practiced here are either Reform or Conservative. So the Hasids are very much of the most Orthodox strain. So you'll see Jews with long beards and, you know, following very strict biblical injunctures. But the difference is that they're the most ecstatic and joyful in their prayers. And, for instance, after Sabbath, there'll be large dances and great joys. And they bring in the most mystical visions. So, you know, that ecstatic of dancing all night and that you won't see in some of the other strains. But they are very insular now. But most of the Orthodox strains tend to be more inclusive than, or more exclusive than inclusive. You know, my way or the highway.
Well, but that's not the way the Baal Shem Tov started this movement. At the time, it was extremely inclusive, and though this joy, this aspect as persisted, as Peter pointed out, this aspect of the joy and the dancing and the singing and the music has persisted. Any of you who've ever heard any klezmer music, you can hardly keep your seat. You feel impelled to get up and dance. It's really wonderful. Klezmer is one of the kinds of music that is played by the Orthodox. Not only them, but... So, thank you, Peter. Thank you for that contribution. Yes, the Hasidim are Orthodox, and they did this in reaction to being attacked. It's not an unfamiliar scenario in religious and spiritual circles. Anybody else? Yes, Dr. Munch.
There are a few thoughts that passed my mind. Number one, two or three times you mentioned how the Jewish people have been literally tortured for following their own religion.
Mm-hmm.
In Europe and everywhere. But there is a book written by a Jewish lady, and she says the only place in the world where Jewish people had no difficulty in settling, no resistance, and actual help is India.
Mm-hmm.
So when they first lodged in India, the king went to the ship to receive them. He says, "I don't have the money to give you, but I have land. So if you want to do your own farming, and stay here. You are very welcome. That synagogue is still there in India. It's, I think it's about 400 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And when I sat there, I had goosebumps.
Mm.
Because of the tremendous endurance a true religion should allow. And then, when I said true religion, then what you said came immediately to my mind, that everything is a part, the entire, every part of the universe is a part of God. Ishavasyam idam sarvam.
See,
even Hindu scriptures also say the same thing.
Yes, of course.
And then I commented on my own word also. What do you mean by also? That also is a differentiation in a subtle form.
Mm-hmm.
If it's a truth, then everyone will say the same thing. And they say, a lie has many variations. But the truth has no variations. So whether, but then we compartmentalize. Jewish people say that, Hindus say that, Muslims say that, Christians say that. That is our compartmentalization. Otherwise, the truth is one, like they say, ekam sat, vipraha, bahudha vadante. Truth is only one. But the wise people are allowed to speak it differently. And
they
by
must, they
listening
must.
To that, we increase and the depth of our wisdom. That's the way I felt.
Very well said.
Speaking about Hindus and Muslims and this and that, Jains also.
Oh, yeah.
Jain religion. They believe in any way, no difference between any agent in any way.
Mm-hmm.
They are all creation of God.
Well, Sri Ramakrishna had the experience sitting there in the Kali Shrine of everything being made of consciousness. Everything.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Not just the image of Kali, but all of the offerings, the water pot, the cat, the door sill, all made of consciousness. And this is
stone, bugs, beasts.
Mm-hmm. So this is what we are to assimilate. You know, this is what we're in the presence of. So it leads to being more reverent. You know, our devotion is kindled when we find reason to be reverent. And the fact that everything is made of consciousness, everything is consciousness, it's a reason for us to be reverent and careful and loving, compassionate, all those things that are in St. Francis's prayer. So, is there anything else?
I have a question about what is the nature of the spiritual visions and the spiritual experiences he had?
Oh my goodness, oh yes. Well, he regularly had, even from his boyhood, he had visitations by Elijah. And then he had visitations when it was time for him to, so to speak, go public with his teachings and with his work. He was visited not only by Elijah, but Elijah's teacher, who I don't remember, it starts with H, but I just thought it was the name of the teacher. I didn't have time to look into it. But the name of the teacher was, as Adi Shankaracharya is, we have Acharya, the teacher that was, Elijah's teacher was Anachia. And you can see in context, it's exactly the same word. The great spiritual teacher. And so he had many visitations from the Divine Presence in the form of the prophets, and just his, you know, he would go into samadhi, and people would come from miles around to see him pray, because he would then go into samadhi and there was this effulgence. As I said, you know, a whole day could be spent on nothing but talking about the biography of this man. And he's one of those who really made a difference in the life of his people. So yes, Elijah was, and if we think about Elijah, Elijah was, according to the mystical Christian tradition, Elijah was a prior incarnation of Christ. Isaiah and Elijah. So here are some more of the Baal Shem Tov's teachings that I found. And he quotes this, "Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself," which of course is a Christian teaching. He said, "Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself." Why? Because every human being has a root in the unity, and to reject the minutest particle of the unity is to reject it all. Your fellow man is your mirror. If your own face is clean, the image you perceive will also be flawless. But should you look upon your fellow man and see a blemish, it is your own imperfection that you are encountering. You are being shown what it is that you must correct within yourself. And of course, this is one of these great teachings that goes across all the traditions. And Goethe put it so well. A man sees in the world what he carries in his heart. A man sees in the world what he carries in his heart. And of course, Sri Ramakrishna tells the story about the child who, though there's a bag of gold and someone comes and takes the gold, the child, the infant, sees no thief because there's no thief in his mind.
Can you read that again?
Your fellow man is your mirror. If your own face is clean, the image you perceive will also be flawless. But should you look upon your fellow man and see a blemish, it is your own imperfection that you are encountering. You are being shown what it is that you must correct within yourself. Next, the ideal of man is to be a revelation himself, clearly to recognize himself as a manifestation of God. Whenever feeling downcast, each person should vitally remember, "For my sake, the entire world was created." Who's the my? Huh? It's not the tiny personality. And William Blake put it so well. I just love this quote from Blake. We should think of ourselves as, the word has slipped away. We should think of ourselves. What he's saying is, we're immortal beings and we should think of ourselves that way. I've forgotten the turn of phrase. I don't know why it went out of my mind. I should have typed it all here. but in any event, that's what the Baal Shem Tov is saying. The ideal of man is to be a revelation of himself, clearly to recognize himself as a manifestation of God. Whenever feeling downcast, each person should vitally remember, "For my sake, the entire world was created." And then this, we're taught within this lineage the word recollectedness. Krishna teaches it one way or another over and over in the Gita. Think of me, he said. The Baal Shem Tov said, forgetfulness leads to exile, while remembrance is the secret of redemption. And then, you know, he had a quite wonderful turn of phrase sometimes. Everybody is unique. Compare not yourself with anybody, lest you spoil God's curriculum. God's plan of education. See to it that every day you do some act of goodness and kindness. In fact, you should eagerly anticipate. Perhaps God will arrange such a good happenstance. Isn't that beautiful? See to it that every day you do some act of goodness and kindness. In fact, you should eagerly anticipate. Perhaps God will arrange such a good happenstance. And then this lesson resonates so with us. There was once a king who was a magician, and so he invited people to have a relationship, a personal connection with him. But as one entered the palace grounds, there were millions of gold coins for the taking. Most people came and took some money. Some came beyond the palace grounds to the interior, where they found even greater riches. And so it was chamber after chamber. However, the king's son ignored all that and went straight to the king.
Source.
Take no pride in the good you have done. Imagine that it was God. I, God, have not changed. This is a quote from the Torah. I, God, have not changed. In other words, God saying, I am the changeless. I, God, have not changed. It is only that God conceals himself in the miraculous repetitiveness of nature. However, once man is aware that everything is God, one of the fundamental secrets, there is no more separation or concealment. And I'll conclude with this. For it's said that the hallmark of the Holy One is humility. Here's the rationale. For any of us to come to the understanding that we are common and unlearned is the accomplishment of a lifetime. As I said, he had a turn of phrase that was often quite humorous. For any of us to come to the understanding that we are common and unlearned is the accomplishment of a lifetime. Robert Frost put it this way. We dance around in a ring and suppose the secret sits in the middle and knows. So we have a few minutes, now that we've done a little more discussion of the Baal Shem Tov's teachings. Is there anything else that anyone would like to bring up or discuss?
Brother?
Yes.
I have a comment and a question.
Yes.
The first one is the Baal Shem Tov's quote which you mentioned at the beginning. Every other person is a mirror. Like whatever flaws he sees, like he might see in the other people also. That is in line with in the Mahabharata. It goes like when Yudhishthira was asked to find any bad person, he was not able to find anyone. And similarly, Duryodhana, he was asked to find any good person. He told that I cannot find any good person. So whatever they see in the heart, they see outside.
Yes, precisely. precisely. I said all of this is very familiar to us. But, you know, God is one. Sages call him by many names. There was another comment or question over here.
Yeah, one more question.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, can you tell more about, like, Jewish religion? Like, it's a very broad question about its origin and why it was like, like even Christianity surpassed it. So what are that beliefs, like, whether Jewish religion believes in spreading of the religion or it is similar to Hinduism where they don't, conversion thing is not a main agenda?
It's very difficult to convert to Judaism. They will push you away, very strongly push you away three times before they will take you seriously to convert. And no, it's not an evangelical religion. It's not a proselytizing religion in any sense of the word. As a matter of fact, the Jews have a reputation for being inward directed, not outward directed, and keeping to themselves. And it's one of the things that they have been persecuted for over the many, many centuries of heavy persecution. Because they're accused of all kinds of secretiveness and all kinds of nonsense. That now, as far as the Jewish religion, that, as you say, is a big question. if you want to know more about it, just Google Moses and Abraham. Just go. I don't want to take time to go into it. Not that I know it well enough to really give you a detailed answer. But the Jewish people were a group that saw Moses as their leader while they were all slaves, and everyone was slaves of the Pharaoh except for this upper crust of people. Everyone in Egypt, it wasn't just the Jews, everyone was a slave. Everyone did the Pharaoh's bidding or died. So the people who became followers of Moses, and he led them, first he persuaded the Pharaoh with the in his relationship with God, he persuaded the Pharaoh to release these slaves and let them go on their way. So just exactly what the relationship of those people was with one another before Moses brought them together is unclear. And there's nothing in the Egyptian writings that tell anything about it. So we have only what's in the Torah. And so you have to reach your own conclusion. Understanding that the mystical and Talmudic, many of the Talmudic scholars say that the Torah is metaphor. That it's not a historical document, it's a metaphorical document. But I don't know enough to say that anything more about that than just that that's what I've read and heard. If you want to know more, you can ask Steve Gold or Peter, Peter Cower in the back.
I will just make one comment. If you've studied, remember there are three major religions that come out of that, called the religions of the book, and they all come out of Abraham. So that's Judaism, Islam, and Christianity. So if you followed and understand the origins of Christianity before Jesus, that's the history of the Jews as well. And also, up to a point, Islam, too.
I think...
Well, hold on. There was someone else who raised their hand back. Yes?
Brother, I just had a comment about the interconnectedness and the relatedness of things that we've been talking about. So, in the Brahmanas, which are texts on the Vedas, which... detail the ritual procedures.
Mm-hmm.
So there are often questions asked about, say, how something could be used in place of the other. So there would be injunctions which would say detail that in place of wheat you can use rice. And in explaining that, the Brahmanas then give this notion of Bandhava, which is relatedness. So everything is related with each other. And so this kind of idea has been there since the beginning of the Vedic rituals.
Mm-hmm.
And that then creates a kind of efficacy which is believed to be present in something else and something completely unrelated in something that we wouldn't have, say, kind of conceived of. So just talking about the relatedness of things. And Thakur also talks about it. It's in the beginning of the gospel. So when asks the attendant about Thakur doing the Sandhya Vandan, the twilight worship.
Mm-hmm.
So Thakur, says that the Sandhya merges in Gayatri and the Gayatri merges in Pranav.
Mm-hmm.
So there is two kinds of process. So everything is coming from the Pranav, from the Om, and then it also merges back. And therefore, everything is related.
Yes, and if we look at the logic of it, it must be so.
Yeah.
It cannot be otherwise. Vivekananda nails this in Gyan, in his book, in the series of lectures collected as Jnana Yoga. It cannot be otherwise. Uma.
The roots of Christianity are in Judaism, isn't it?
Say it again, dear.
Old Testament. New Testament, but before the Old Testament.
Well, the what Christ said is, I bring you a new covenant with God. I bring you a new understanding of a relationship with the divine. A much more personal one. A much more intimate one than is present in Judaism as it was practiced at the time that Christ was in Israel. The mystical strain of Judaism that teaches this intimate personal relationship with the divine and the fact of your divinity as a human being, you are nothing more than a manifestation of the divine, as the Baal Shem Tov taught. This is embedded in, but not in, as Jesus said to the Pharisees, you have the keys to the kingdom, and you neither use them nor share them. And this was his indictment of them.
Wasn't Jesus himself a Jew?
Of course. He was a Nazarene. He was born in Nazareth. He was definitely Jewish. I mean, he was not a Christian. There was no such thing. You know? He was a good observant Jew up to a point. Then he said the relationship with the divine supersedes the law. And so there were injunctions about fasting and this and that. That he said to his disciples, we just don't need to observe that. So he was a reformer. And that's why he was killed. Because he was attempting to reform this system that had been worked out, that was a very cozy relationship of the powerful with the Romans. And it was not a pretty picture, as far as the mass of humanity was concerned, the mass of the Jewish people.
Just as the counter argument, it was more of a political act by the Romans killing Jesus than a religious act of Jews killing Jesus.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's been kind of a point of contention for the last couple thousand years.
Yeah. Yes. Well, I wasn't placing blame. I was simply saying that Jesus was killed for disturbing that cozy relationship, regardless of who it was that pulled the trigger, so to speak. Anything else? Wonderful. Okay. We have this wonderful closing prayer that if we think about it as we say it, and we think about what would happen if it actually came to be, as Vivekananda said, the universe as we know it would disappear. If the gunas all came into equilibrium, if there was perfect peace, the universe as we know it would disappear. So let's just think about what it is we're praying for. Yogeshananda did this beautiful translation, Swami Yogeshananda. Say a prayer for Yogeshananda. Each of you who loves him, say a prayer for him. He's suffering. His vision is gone. His hearing is gone. His balance is gone. And the mind is still sharp. I got a beautiful email from him the other day. But he's definitely ready to leave this mortal coil. So a prayer for his well-being and a sweet departure would be auspicious. This is his translation of this ancient prayer. Let there be peace in outer space.
Let there be peace in outer space.
Let there be peace in the sky, on the earth, and in the waters.
Let there be peace in the sky, on the earth, and in the waters.
Let there be peace in the herbs, the plants, and the trees.
Let there be peace in the herbs, the plants, and the trees.
May the gods be peaceful.
May the gods be peaceful.
May the whole universe be pervaded by peace.
May the whole universe be pervaded by peace.
Let this infinite universal peace prevail throughout my being.
Let this infinite universal peace prevail throughout my being.
Om. Shanti, shanti, shanti. Om, peace, peace, peace be unto us and to all beings everywhere. Om, Hari Om, Tat Sat.